Welcome, everyone. It's an honor to speak with all of you today on a topic that is both personal and professional: advancing diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility at the State Department. As an African-American woman diplomat, I am one of very few career Foreign Service officers to rise to the level of ambassador. And if I reflect on the last 40 years from when I started my public service as a Peace Corps volunteer in Oman to the current moment, one thing is clear. I am still often the only woman of color in the room, and frankly, the only woman. So the question I've carried with me my entire career, and that I grapple with to this day: how do we build more inclusive leadership pipelines into the department and ensure, once we do bring this diverse talent in, that everyone feels they have an equal ability to rise up the ranks? I want you to know that I see and acknowledge the tremendous work you've carried out in the last year and a half. My team and I are building upon the strong foundation of your collective labor. I also want to thank you for your patience. While our office did not begin to truly staff up until a month ago, we are off and running now. Now, we've begun to dig into the work, and there is plenty to do. Our newly launched SharePort site includes positions still pending in our office. We also welcome Y-tours, details, fellows, and other arrangements. If you're passionate about improving the department, contact us. When the Secretary appointed me to this post, he made clear that my mandate is to lead the change in the part of the department's culture, our norms, our behaviors, and our biases that stifle diversity, equity, and inclusion. So now I want to share with you what you can expect from my team in the coming months, because this office is all about action. Let me be clear that we are done talking. Instead, we are focusing on what we can put into motion that will lead to systemic change. I have a motto that guides my work: intentionality, transparency, and accountability. First, we need to be intentional. This means changing the culture of our institution so that every single employee feels invested in advancing DEIA work. As the Secretary has stated many times, an inclusive workforce is not just a nice to have, it is a national security imperative. The United States is the most diverse and powerful nation in the world. Other countries are watching us. When we fail to live up to our ideals, our adversaries are ready to exploit our shortcomings. That's why it's critical that we integrate DEIA as a lens to not only reform our institution on the inside, but guide how we conduct our foreign policy. On July 21st, the Secretary and I launched and led a DEIA Leadership Council with Deputy Assistant Secretaries and DEIA advisors from across the department. This council will work to implement the department's five-year diversity and inclusion strategic plan, the DISP, and oversee its implementation. My team is working to finalize it later this summer. Our goal, with discussions like this one, the one we're having now, is to turn your feedback into concrete, actionable change. Secondly, we need to be transparent. If we are serious about addressing systemic inequities, then we need to be transparent about what we're dismantling. This means collecting demographic data on hiring, assignments, promotions, attrition, and other key milestones so that we understand better who is at the table and why we see fewer underrepresented groups rising up the ranks. This data is critical so we can identify the barriers that are preventing equitable career outcomes. This is why one of our first actions was to launch a DEIA data working group. I strongly believe that we need to establish a clear demographic baseline for the department against which future progress will be measured. This is a top priority for the Secretary. In the run-up to establishing that foundational demographic baseline, we encourage all of you to self-identify in GEMS and encourage your colleagues to do the same. I'd like to give you a tangible example of why data disclosure and self-identification are so critical to our work. One in every five Americans is an individual with a disability. Individuals with disabilities have a right to reasonable accommodations in the workplace. But research shows that 73% of employees with disabilities do not disclose, making them unable to request reasonable accommodations. There's no doubt that the stigma associated with disability persists. In our workplace, only 8% of Foreign Service members identify as having a disability, and less than 1% identify as having a targeted disability, which include conditions like deafness and blindness. The civil service numbers aren't much better. I've heard from employees that there is a fear of disclosure and not wanting to share information with their colleagues in the Bureau of Medical Services. Disclosure and self-identification, however, are crucial, critical to our data collection efforts, which I want to stress are and will remain anonymous. When we have access to the data, we are better equipped to make the case for resources and policies that we need to make the department equitable and more accessible for all. And lastly, perhaps most importantly, we need to hold ourselves and our institution accountable. The department's risk-averse culture often hardwires employees to keep our heads down, to not speak up when abusive or discriminatory or inappropriate behavior happens. Accountability is about changing the processes and structures that contribute to this culture. Accountability also means we must work to create incentive structures that reward behavior that advances DEIA, as well as strengthen the consequences for those who discriminate, harass, or employ bullying or other toxic management practices in the workplace. As a voting member of the Deputies Committee, the Deputy Chief of Mission and Principal Officer Committee, and the Civil Service Executive Resources Board, I can tell you, we have already begun to strengthen accountability mechanisms by working to ensure candidates for these key senior positions have a track record of implementing DEIA and have no history of bullying, ableism, discrimination, harassment, or other toxic management practices. Our team and I will also work to strengthen vetting and discipline processes to ensure stronger consequences for managers and employees at all levels who engage in discrimination, harassment, or bullying. We need it to stop. As the Secretary has said many times, this transformation will take all of us. Change happens from the top down with signals from leadership, but also from the bottom up. We're at a historic alignment with the Secretary, the White House, the Hill, the broader interagency, and the American people demand that we do better. Your grassroots activism is the fuel to keep the momentum and the spotlight on these issues. My team and I want to hear from you, and we ask that you reach out to us at diversity@state.gov. A list of our team members, many of whom you will recognize as having long been active in this space, is available on our SharePoint site. We hope the SharePoint site will be a dynamic forum for robust engagement, the place to go for updates and announcements on policy changes as we implement them, a clearinghouse for DEIA best practices, cables, programs, and more. We're also building a discussion board so that you can interact with us and each other to share ideas, concerns, and solutions that can build the kind of workforce where everyone is equitably valued and can realize our full potential. And with that, I'd like to introduce my colleague, Constance Mayer, our office's Deputy Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer. And she's going to moderate the questions that we have received from you. Connie, over to you.
Thank you, Madam Ambassador. So the first question is from James Shea in EAP, and his question is, Fellowships and programs, such as the Charles B. Rangel International Affairs Program, the Thomas P. R. Pickering Foreign Affairs Fellowship Program, and the International Career Advancement Program, allow the Department of State to further diversify its personnel. Is the department considering expanding some of these existing programs and/or looking at new programs and engagements that can help attract a more diverse workforce? How can we leverage our diplomats and residents to increase participation in these programs and bring in new diverse officers?
Great. James, thank you for the question. The programs you mentioned are incredibly valuable tools for diversifying recruitment. I was an ICAP participant myself, and I can tell you that they have already begun to be expanded. So, we also need to tap into our diplomats and residents, who are spread out geographically across the country and are critical to our efforts to build more diverse pipelines into the department. My office seeks to leverage these existing tools, but also think outside the box on who we are engaging. It's not enough to reach out to the same institutions in the same areas, and many of these institutions are well-resourced and already engaged in recruiting for the department. Most of these institutions are within the Beltway, and those who do the best job of turning out successful applicants to the Department of State. But we need to engage new audiences. My team is building an outreach strategy to engage community colleges across the country. We're looking to partner with decentralized nationwide networks, organizations that work with underrepresented groups. This will ensure that we're getting the word out across the board. As I said, the Secretary has said, my office can't do the work of advancing diversity, inclusion, equity, and accessibility alone. It's necessary to work all of us together, and we welcome your suggestions. If you have ideas on who we should connect with and have contacts, let us know. You can reach out to my team, as I said earlier, at diversity@state.gov with ideas. James, thank you.
Okay. This question is from Catherine Morgan in GTM. How does the U.S. Department of State expect to improve diversity statistics when the department and bureaus are not required to make structural changes to the way we recruit, hire, train, develop, and promote people?
Yeah. Thank you, Catherine. Your question gets at the heart of the collective challenge we face. There are two parts to this, making overdue changes to many aspects of our personnel system and then holding ourselves accountable for implementing those changes. You're right. We need to make structural improvements to how we recruit, hire, train, develop, promote, and retain our most valuable resources, our people. That's exactly what my office is undertaking. We're rolling up our sleeves to find best practices and share those across the department. You're also correct that real improvement in diversity statistics has too often proven elusive. That's why accountability is so important and why we're also looking at ways to hold bureaus accountable for following through on structural changes and how they bring in, develop, and retain staff. We've started by sharing cold, hard facts on what their bureaus look like. You cannot hide from the numbers. We're working on additional strategies and welcome concrete recommendations. Thank you.
This question is from Tina Wong in EUR. What are your policy priorities regarding data transparency, including but not limited to workforce statistics, foreign service assignments, and civil service hiring, promotions, and awards? And how are you ensuring bureaus are implementing the new EO directives consistently across the department?
Okay. Tina, you speak to my heart. Data transparency. As I said in my remarks, the model that guides our work is intentionality, transparency, and accountability. I believe the data, disaggregated data, is critical to promoting greater transparency so we better understand the inequities that we're trying to dismantle. Data is necessary to create the baselines, and these baselines are necessary to measure our progress, the progress we make to advance DEIA goals. This is why I'm asking all State Department employees to self-identify in GEMS. If you don't know how, you can visit my office's newly launched SharePoint site that has detailed instructions. I want to assure you that this data is anonymized, and our purpose in collecting disaggregated data is to inform how we can better advance DEIA in the department. The second part of your question, we will turn the guidance of the many executive orders coming out of the White House into concrete action. On our SharePoint, we have all of the recent DEIA executive orders listed so everyone in the department has easy access to them. To ensure we operate with a unified whole-of-government approach, the State Department uses the same definitions of diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility that were outlined in the June 25th executive order. I've also launched a foreign affairs executive partnership with all foreign affairs agencies covered under the Foreign Service Act of 1980. We meet quarterly to build interagency collaboration on DEIA, we share best practices, and we harmonize implementation of the White House executive orders. Tina, thank you for your work in advancing DEIA in the department.
This question is from Mike Ross in OBO. I have read some promising research on how the anonymization of applications increases both diversity and quality in hiring actions. What are your thoughts on anonymizing applications in the hiring process across all levels of the department?
Mike, thank you for raising this. I believe I know some of the studies that you were referring to. The conclusions regarding anonymity are quite compelling. My team and I are working with Global Talent Management to identify areas where we can mitigate biases in hiring decisions. They may include ensuring candidate anonymity during the qualifications evaluation panel, QEP process, for the Foreign Service, or redacting genders and names from resumes for civil service employees and locally engaged staff during hiring. Of course, transparency must be considered, as anonymity alone does not guarantee complete elimination of bias. Other demographic indicators exist in QEP responses and in resumes, so complete anonymity may not be practical. I referred to the importance of data in one of my earlier responses, and I want to ensure any measure we take to mitigate bias, including using anonymity as appropriate, would achieve the intended result before endorsing a system-wide change. Thanks.
This question is from Carol Marks in the Office of Employee Relations. The Foreign Service assignments process is designed to be an old boys network. Foreign Service members are advised to network and lobby to obtain assignments. In the meetings that are held to decide who will be selected for a position, the conversations can be informal and unrecorded. This makes it very easy for conscious and unconscious bias to have a significant effect on the assignments process. What steps are being taken to remove this bias from the Foreign Service assignment process?
Highlighting new procedures that various bureaus are piloting this year to end the subjective nature with which assignments are currently made. I encourage you to flag that cable for your post and your bureau leadership and ask, are we implementing all of these measures? A similar message has gone out from GTM to improve hiring techniques for the civil service. Flag it for hiring managers. The measures include establishing and announcing clear criteria for who gets an interview, using interview panels that include members of the bureaus or post-DEIA council, publishing a bidder's bill of right for each bureau or post, standardizing interviewing formats and questions, using skills-based interview questions to ensure an emphasis on skills and experience rather than networks. encouraging hiring managers to take FSI's Mitigating Unconscious Bias course and announcing a senior level POC who bidders can go to if the Bureau is not following its published rules. With the exception of disabilities, the law does not allow hiring managers to consider race, gender, or other EEO categories in hiring decisions, but we can push bureaus to recruit with greater diversity, equity, and transparency in mind. They can do concrete things like partner with affinity groups for recruitment events. We're also using data to show bureaus where they stand and where they have room for improvement. Our office recently shared with each bureau front office how their employee base stacks up by race, gender, ethnicity, and disability. And this data was broken down by rank and by civil service and foreign service membership. The details are very telling and will help generate some healthy competition among bureaus to do a better job building more inclusive teams. At the senior levels, I sit on the selection panels for Chiefs of Mission DCMs principal officers, and I call out bias and lack of transparency where I see it. I'm also stressing that leaders at this level must have a demonstrated track record of concrete ways they have advanced DEIA goals in order to secure these jobs. Thank you.
So this next question was submitted anonymously. There has been a lot of discussion about the effects of improved diversity, equity, and inclusion as it relates to the people doing the work in terms of recruitment, hiring, retention, which is important. Equally important, however, is the work that the department does. In what ways is your office considering improving the work we do through the same lens?
Thank you for this question. Our office is working closely with the Deputy Secretary for Management and Resources, DMR, to ensure that we are integrating an equity lens, not only internally, but in our foreign policy work. On March 29th, DMR launched an agency equity teams focusing on five key priorities. Number one, leveraging programming, grants, and foreign assistance to advance racial equity and support underserved communities, both within the United States and overseas. Number two, ensuring U.S. foreign policy development is inclusive and reflective of mutually beneficial outcomes for all stakeholders. Number three, promoting equitable representation of underserved communities in public engagements and exchange programs. Four, advancing equitable procurement and contracting opportunities for underserved communities. And finally, five, expanding consular affairs resources available to underserved American communities. Agency equity team working groups have spent the last few months evaluating the department's current efforts, which fed into the department's 200-day equity assessment that was submitted on August 5th. As I mentioned in my opening remarks, advancing DEIA, whether it's within the department or in our foreign policy work, is like exercising a muscle. This cannot be a box-checking exercise during Black History Month or Women's International Day. Equity, inclusion, and accessibility, these are core values that we must integrate into everything we do, every day.
Okay, Madam Ambassador, this next question was also submitted anonymously. What efforts is the Department of State planning or currently undertaking to improve diversity within its leadership positions across both the civil and foreign service?
Important question. I firmly believe that our leadership must reflect the demographics of the workforce. Employees need to see themselves in the department leadership to know that everyone has an opportunity to achieve their career goals. If our leadership is overwhelmingly from the same demographic, it sends a terrible signal to others that we do not stand by our own ideals when it comes to valuing the strength that comes from our diversity. As CDIO, I'm a member of the committees responsible for the selection of these senior positions, chiefs of mission, deputy chiefs of mission, etc. And part of my role is to ensure that Bureau shortlists reflect the diverse selection of candidates and that diverse candidates are given an equitable consideration in the decision-making process. In addition, my role includes leading the review of each candidate's response on their record of promoting diversity and inclusion among the workforce. My team has worked with other offices to compile demographics for all bureaus to serve as a baseline to measure our efforts going forward. We are going to monitor demographics to identify which bureaus are more successful at recruiting and promoting a diverse workforce, as well as identifying the ones who continue to struggle. Informed by data, we intend to capitalize on the best practices of successful bureaus to learn what works in eliminating barriers and hold other bureaus accountable for doing the same and achieving meaningful progress.
Okay, Madam Ambassador, another anonymous question. According to a 2020 Harvard Business Review article, although 90% of employers claim to prioritize diversity, only 4% consider disabilities in their initiatives. Even when disability is considered, employers tend to overlook so-called invisible disabilities, such as mental health struggles, learning differences, and neurodiversity. How does the department plan to support, first, employees with invisible disabilities, and secondly, Foreign Service children struggling with these same issues while attending international schools that are not obligated to support them?
Yeah, very important and something that many of us struggle with. Supporting employees with invisible disabilities can be challenging, as many don't consider them unless you have one or you know someone with this kind of disability. As a department, we must do a better job of incorporating this knowledge into our regular training regimen for all levels of our organization, just like we do for equal employment opportunity or cybersecurity. My team intends to work with FSI on developing training curricula on accessibility to include invisible disabilities to ensure all department employees receive this information. Whether you are a peer or a supervisor, we all have the responsibility to ensure our workplace is respectful and inclusive. I would also encourage all supervisors to show consideration to workplace flexibility requests within their control. Employees may be uncomfortable disclosing or may not even know they have an invisible disability. For example, an employee with anxiety may ask for an alternate work schedule to avoid commuting during peak rush hour, which is a trigger for them. Or an employee with diabetes may need a fixed break times through their day for injections. While reasonable accommodations are covered by the ADA, if the employee is only asking for relatively simple workplace flexibility, that doesn't have a cost and has a negligible impact on the office, it's not necessary to ask them a lot of questions to justify the request or involve DRAD. The second part of the question involving children with disabilities is harder to address because overseas schools are not required to accommodate their needs as a U.S. public school would be. There is an existing support process through MED, but my office has heard from several Foreign Service parents who believe the Class 2 medical clearance process for their children is overly subjective and burdensome and is detrimental to their careers. My office has also received concerns about the lack of transparency on the special needs education allowance. We intend to work with MED to learn more about these concerns and find ways to address them to ensure our entire community, including our children, receive the support they need to succeed. Thank you.
Okay, this next question was submitted by Marcy Friedman in GTM. What is the department doing to rout out anti-Semitism within the department, especially in light of the swastika incident and rising anti-Jewish sentiment and activities both at home and abroad?
Marcy, thank you for that question. One of the things I think about you know, that has changed since that swastika is that I get into the elevators every morning near my office and I look around to see if they are intact. As a department's chief diversity and inclusion officer, I am committed to creating an environment where all employees feel safe. The incident of the swastika carved in a department elevator disturbed us all. And I understand why people might not feel safe. This flagrant display of anti-Semitism is emblematic of larger systemic failures which enable hate to thrive. My office is working to identify and close accountability loopholes, but we can't hold someone accountable if we cannot identify them. There are no cameras in department elevators, and up to this point, DS does not have other camera footage that has allowed them to identify who did this. On the broader subject of the rising level of anti-Jewish sentiment and broader systemic discrimination at home and abroad, my office is looking at the policies in place that determine our responses to incidents of hate, whether it's online or in real life. We're re-examining, as a department, this policy from top to bottom, including the legal interpretation of existing case law and various points along the chain that determine how and whether an employee is deemed fit to continue employment. For example, currently, employees are only given a suitability review when first hired and when selected for a senior position. We're asking, why can't we do regular suitability reviews in the same way that an employee's security and medical clearances are reviewed? They're all important. 2 weeks ago, I initiated a meeting with the heads of diplomatic security, legal affairs, and the Office of Civil Rights and Global Talent Management to think creatively about how can we implement greater accountability in such instances. I guarantee you that if there is a way to legally square this circle, and I'm convinced there must be, my team and I are determined to find it. Department culture will not change unless we change department policy on accountability. I would encourage all of you to take a pledge to find tangible ways to combat hate in the workplace, in your communities, and in our foreign policy work. If you are at an embassy or in an office that does programming, initiate programming to counter anti-Semitism or confront Holocaust distortion or minimization. You can also get involved via social media campaigns or demonstrate virtually or in real life your support for colleagues and our fellow citizens who are feeling vulnerable. When we encounter anti-Semitism or any other form of hate, it is incumbent upon all of us to speak out. I hope that if any of you see evidence of any speech or action from another colleague that you would consider anti-Semitic, please speak up in the moment and say that it's not okay and then report it, because we all have an obligation to speak up against such sentiment and to create a department culture that upholds the norm that such views are not acceptable. Thank you.
This question was submitted anonymously. What is the department's action plan to retain people of color and other diverse groups in the agency and allow growth and achievement? People have been leaving because of mistreatment from management, lack of advancement and training opportunities, and management taking ownership of employees' careers instead of mentoring and investing in their staff.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. Retention and advancement certainly go hand in hand. And as this question points out, so does accountability. We have heard from a number of colleagues about how the lack of accountability in our system erodes morale and leads to people leaving. Accountability is one of my biggest priorities. My team is re-examining the accountability issue from end to end, including EEO and harassment reporting mechanisms, discipline, grievance board and appeals mechanisms, and the advancement of managers who are serial abusers, whether that means discrimination, harassment, or bullying. And of course, bullying is not against the law, but it is equally problematic. We have already strengthened vetting mechanisms for chiefs of mission, DCMs, and principal officers to ensure problematic leaders are not simply rewarded for simply learning how to circumvent the system. We're not perfect yet, but we are moving strongly. We are also emphasizing the need for senior leaders to get involved when discrimination or harassment are reported. Just this week, I spoke with the Ambassadorial Leadership Seminar and emphasized that it is no longer acceptable for leaders to stick our head in the sand once an issue has been reported to the Office of Civil Rights. We must act immediately, both to prevent the activity from continuing and to protect our employees who have been impacted from retaliation. I'm also working with OCR and Global Talent Management to strengthen our discipline framework for supervisors who fail to report or act on this information. Accountability also means incentivizing DEIA work among our leaders. We have thus proposed changes to the promotion precepts and senior performance pay processes to ensure all employees must put pen to paper on how they've advanced DEIA work. On training and advancement, we hope to pilot a new sponsorship mentoring program that will target those who are underrepresented at the senior ranks and that will include allies who have a demonstrated track record of advancing DEIA goals. Thank you.
Okay, so we have another anonymous question. Where is the line between employees bringing grievances to a DEIA council versus the role of EEO counselors and other HR mechanisms? What happens when lines are blurred and leadership becomes upset because grievances are coming from the DEIA channel?
Okay, an important question. And I want you to listen closely to the answer because it may differ from what you've heard in the past. Reports of harassment, discrimination, and bullying should always be reported via two channels, both to the Office of Civil Rights and to senior leadership in your post or bureau. SOCR has sole responsibility for investigating those complaints, but because that process can take months and sometimes years to resolve, it is also important that employees inform and engage their chain of command if they want resolution or mitigation sooner. What I'm going to say next is also important. There is nothing that prohibits employees from disclosing behavior that constitutes discrimination, harassment, or bullying to other colleagues, to other peers and senior leaders, or to their DEIA council, even after it's been reported to SOCR. Department culture has taught us to keep our experiences as close to the chest as possible, and that is part of why the behavior and the lack of accountability have persisted. People simply don't know. Now, I know a lot of why people keep this close to the chest is because they fear retaliation or damage to their own reputation. That is a trickier knot to untangle, but part of my message to chiefs of mission is that they must act immediately to prevent the behavior from continuing and to protect the employee from retaliation. If I were a senior leader and this sort of information were coming to me from the DEIA Council, I would take it as a sign that employees do not feel comfortable disclosing it through their supervisory chain. And that would be a red flag for me that says I need to pay careful and immediate attention to this. If employees do not feel comfortable sharing the information directly with managers and are going through the DEIA Council, that would say something to me about the fidelity, perceived or real, of the chain of command and its willingness to both address the issue and protect those impacted from retaliation. The DEIA Council can play a useful role in this regard. An employee may report what they think is an issue only affecting them personally. But if the DEIA Council is hearing about this issue from several employees, it could flag a more widespread concern that is important for senior leadership, HR, and OCR to be aware of and handle. If this is happening and Post leadership is getting upset with the council for raising it, please bring that to our attention, and we can help by engaging both with Post and Bureau leadership. We hope this is not the bulk of the work that any DEIA council is taking on, but we do understand why it may sometimes happen, and we are here to help. My office's remit is not to investigate individual reports. Again, that belongs to SOCR. But we do get involved to flag and address systemic, pervasive issues for correction. Again, OCR's role is to investigate individual cases. Our office is going to address systemic ones, but oftentimes both are manifesting at once, and both need to be tackled through different channels. Thank you.
Hey, Madam Ambassador, this is going to be the last question, and it was submitted anonymously. I appreciate that a recent executive order specifies advancing equity in the workplace for LGBTQI plus public servants. What can your office do to help ensure missions are prioritizing the acquisition of full diplomatic accreditation, including immunity and privileges for same-sex spouses of diplomats serving overseas?
This is an equity issue that also has serious safety and security implications for our LGBTQI plus employees. Today, 71 countries criminalize being gay. According to GLIFA, about 70 countries do not grant diplomatic status to Foreign Service same-sex spouses and family members. Employees with same-sex spouses and family members have to make a choice between career and family due to accreditation issues, and this makes it an issue of equity that my office engages on. In most cases, these countries do not allow privileges and immunities for same-sex spouses, and therefore do not guarantee their safety, eligibility to work, and in some cases, the ability to enter and leave the host country freely. M established a working group earlier this year to address this issue, and I will continue to engage with leadership of regional bureaus to discuss the options that the U.S. government has at our disposal to encourage countries to accredit LGBTQI plus employees. I will also encourage regional bureaus to begin discussions now with host governments and not wait until an LGBTQI plus employee is assigned to the country, only to find out that their spouse and family members' safety and security could be put at risk by being posted there. We will also work through the Secretary's new DEIA Leadership Council, which is made up of Bureau DASs, to address this issue. I want to thank you all for the questions. Again, please reach out to us at diversity@state.gov for further suggestions, recommendations on how we can make concrete the goals that we have for this office and for our organization. Thank you very much.